Third, 1983, with Diana Lozano, L-O-Z-A-N-O, room 415 of the old executive office building. The interviewer is Marie Allen, A-L-L-E-N, Director, Presidential Records Staff. We cut off the date a little bit on the introduction. The date is February 3rd, 1983. Diana has just walked in, so we have no advance preparation particularly for this. But perhaps we can start with your background, your personal background. One of the purposes of the tapes is to retain a little bit of the personhood of staff members. Where did you grow up and go to school?
Well, I'm a Californian native. I'm from Sunnyvale, California. I'm a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley, so Governor Reagan signed my diploma when I graduated in 1970. And subsequent to graduation, after a year of grad school, I came to Washington on a summer internship program. Caught a raging case of Potomac fever and never went back to school. That was during the Nixon administration. 9 months later, I found myself in the Nixon White House.
What were you doing there?
In the Office of Communications under Herb Klein. And what I did there is I started the research for what later became the first national Hispanic political campaign in 72. So in 1972, I took what I had learned to the campaign and went to the campaign staff and did the Hispanic campaign. Stayed on through the Ford administration at the what is now the Minority Business Development Agency as an executive assistant to the director. The director was the man who had run the Hispanic campaign, so we went together.
What was his name?
Alex Armendariz, an excellent political strategist. And so I spent the remainder of the Ford administration there. And upon the election of Jimmy Carter, looked for a position in the private sector and joined IBM as a marketing representative in New York City. I spent 4 years with IBM, and when I left to come here, I was the account manager for the Citibank account for IBM. I had been working as a volunteer, gearing up again for the Reagan campaign in the Hispanic area, and was commuting weekends from New York to Virginia to work with the campaign, and I worked helped write the strategy and implement it and doing most of the communications and fact sheets and things like that. So it was as a result of that work that Elizabeth Dole asked me whether I would be interested in joining her staff.
Now, can I stop a minute
Sure.
and talk a little bit more about the campaign before
Sure.
we move into the White House experience? When you say Virginia, you meant the Arlington
Yes.
headquarters of
Yes.
the campaign. What was the first the organizational structure? Who were you working with there?
There were, as in previous campaigns, a number of voter group, constituent group organizations. And I was affiliated with the Hispanics for Reagan Bush effort. And it was a national effort targeted to Hispanics, primarily Mexican Americans in the Southwest, to a lesser extent Puerto Ricans on the East Coast, and Cuban Americans in Florida. So I was working for Alex Armendariz, who was the director of that effort. Henry Zuniga was, I think the deputy was his title in that staff, and he now is here also in the Office of Public Liaison in the White House, and he does the outreach to Hispanics. That was a natural spot for him. And there were about three or four, I guess, paid campaign people, and then a number of us who volunteered whenever we could. And my participation was primarily at the beginning, writing the strategy and taking what we had learned from the 1972 campaign, which was very successful for Richard Nixon, and from the 1976 campaign, which was somewhat less successful for a number of reasons in the 4 years, and trying to adapt that and see what we needed to change and how we needed to move ahead to do the best we could with Hispanic voters.
Can you, and just in a general way, indicate what you had learned, what you brought from that 72 campaign, and what you tried to avoid from the later one?
Yes. Well, the 72 campaign was different because it was an incumbency, right? And when you have the resources of the incumbency at your disposal, it's a different ballgame altogether. Hopefully in 1984 we will have a lot more to draw on there, but basically it was a targeting effort for the first time to try to determine among this vast Hispanic community who really were the people who we should specifically target. And we had to find them, and it was hard for the first time. And so going into 1980 we had a better feel for who those people were, and they were primarily the blue collar and middle-income, upwardly mobile Hispanics who in many ways, although they had been Democrats and are primarily Democrats and have party loyalty to the Democrat Party, were in many ways philosophically very attuned to the president, much more so to Ronald Reagan than they were to Richard Nixon. His conservative beliefs, strong family, the neighborhood, his religious feelings, all were very very appealing to the Hispanic voters. So we were much more effective, I think, in our targeting, going after just the right group of people and forgetting those who would never support us. So that was effective. And then I think the second thing that we learned is how to better use the media. We had a lot more data to deal with, and what we learned is that Hispanics, more than other publics, rely on radio, and specifically Spanish language radio. And if you want to catch those people, the elderly who are not really fluent in English, you have to really make special efforts to get to them. So we spent money targeting this group through the radio, both the English language to get to the younger group, who were more bilingual or fluent just in English, and also targeting spots in Spanish to get to that other group. And it was very successful. And our whole effort for the Hispanics was, I think, nationwide, we got about 35% of the vote, up from 17% in 72, when we were dealing with a base of only 8 or 9%. Previous to that, and we expect to do better in 84.
Must have been quite exciting to have the chance to not just be involved in one campaign, but to learn the lessons and see yourself improving and with each one.
Well, and especially when you stop to consider it had never been done before. In 1972, Hispanics as we know them today, and we accept Hispanics as a constituent group, as a minority group. In 72, they were just fighting for their identity to get out under the minority umbrella and distinguish themselves from blacks, which they were very uncomfortable being lumped with. And in fact, it was reasonable to separate them, because in terms of the background and their aspirations and just about every way, they are significantly different. So we were starting with nothing in 72 and did well. And of course now we have more and more to deal with, more to work with, and the decisions are getting easier. And they're also now, Hispanics as a group, are more accustomed to being dealt with as a group and to being solicited for their support. That makes them more politically sophisticated, so at every election you have to get more sophisticated in the way that you deal with them.
Speaking of techniques of reaching out to them, have you been exploring and working with new polling procedures, our new direct mail procedures? Did you tie in to the Vigory operations at some point in affecting the way that his direct mail campaign was going out?
We did both. As part of our targeting efforts, there was that group of Hispanics, which was very well assimilated, and probably would not appreciate a special effort saying, as a Hispanic, we know that you're interested in blah, blah, blah. So we tied into the regular campaign direct mail efforts, and in addition did our own to address those issues which we knew they were particularly interested in, like the extension of the Voting Rights Act, certain immigration problems, particularly in Texas and California, those border state areas. And also to throw in the little flavor about President Reagan, and this is very important to them, as a Californian understands what a Hispanic is, and therefore, you know, has a good flavor for who you are and where you're coming from, and you've got a friend, you'll have a friend in the White House, which was very effective for that group and was something that worked against President Carter. Being a Southerner and being from Georgia, he was very effective, as we know, with the black population, and that worked to his detriment with the Hispanics, and with President Reagan it was exactly the reverse.
Was your strongest Reagan support from California, from Texas, from those states, western states?
Well, and those are the heavily Hispanic
that's
states.
Right. So
yes, the answer is yes, we did exceedingly well in Texas and in areas where you might not have thought. I mean, in the lower Rio Grande Valley, which is just a bastion of hardcore Kennedy support, the president did exceedingly well. He did well in California, well in New Mexico, and Texas and Arizona. And those are the states, as I said. We were targeting Mexican Americans as opposed to Puerto Ricans. He did less well with Puerto Ricans, who, for a number of reasons, are more traditionally tied into, for lack of a better word, the welfare establishment. They're more sensitive and accustomed to relying on government for solutions than are the Mexican Americans, who are more self, more independent, and less anxious to rely on government. And then, of course, we didn't need to target Cubans too well because they loved the president, and in numbers in excess of 90%, and will continue to do that.
Did you come to an understanding and a handling of this type of concern through a background in sociology in college, or through, is this just something you've taught yourself?
Yes, my background in college contributed very little to my political acumen. I majored in Spanish literature. I am from a Hispanic family, but from Spain, not a Mexican-American family, not Puerto Rican. And so when I hit Washington, D.C., I had absolutely no knowledge of any of this Hispanic business. But I got involved in it because my last name was Lozano, and because I had majored in Spanish literature, my first assignment was in a Mexican-American affairs area at the Department of Education. And it was just a hotbed of political activism, not necessarily Republican activism. And I immediately became associated with some Hispanics who were to become influential subsequently, so I just fell into it by accident. But once there, you know, I caught on very quickly, and now consider myself, I am definitely a Hispanic expert.
Did you come from Spain in your childhood?
My father came from Spain. And he was actually born here. His brothers and sisters were all born there. And it was a very traditional Spanish family, with my grandmother living with us and the little lady, 4.5 feet tall with the black dress and the black bandana, who lived in the United States for 50 years and never spoke a word of English, never did learn.
And had no interest in learning.
And had absolutely no interest or no need, because her family and her friends all spoke Spanish. And there was a little Hispanic, Spanish enclave in California where they all migrated. So it was a very incestuous community.
Was there anything that you would, the lessons that you've learned, things you'd like to change with the next election campaign as far as reaching out to the Hispanic community? Are there things you wish you could have done and weren't able to do, or perhaps didn't think of till afterward from the last effort?
Yes. Well, don't forget, too, and it's from my vantage point, because the work that we've been doing in the Office of Public Liaison really is nothing more or less than it's a continuation of the campaign, only in a what, you know, from an in-office position, because that's what we have been doing, and I've been managing that effort, the outreach. So I think that we've made, the president has done a lot of right things. And in 84, I think the major issue that we're going to have to deal with, and I hope to be involved in this effort very actively, at least from a strategic standpoint, will be how far to go with the Hispanic-ness of our effort. I think our target population now, as I said, is a little more sophisticated. I'm not sure they're going to appreciate a specific targeted effort to them as Hispanics. I think there'll be a lot less of that, and that maybe what we need to do is think of them more as the ethnic slash labor slash Catholic constituent vote. And I think that's the major thing that needs to be addressed. Certainly, you have to do a little of the pure Hispanic business. But I don't know how much of that will be appropriate to get the people that we really want to go after. And certainly, in 84, if things continue, the main issue will be the economy, notwithstanding whatever the president does on civil rights and bilingual education and everything else.
How did it come about then that you moved from the campaign into the White House? Was it a conversation with Elizabeth Dole, or were there a series of conversations leading up?
Well, an area that we haven't talked about, because we've been really focusing on the Hispanic thing, is of course the women's issue.
Yes.
which I have spent even more time on in this job than before. But basically, Elizabeth Dole had been appointed assistant to the president for public liaison, and because she's a woman, she was sensitive to the need, and she was going to have two line deputies. She had one already, who was a Lithuanian Catholic white fellow, and
was
she
this Red
Red Cavani is no Red Cavani is her is the deputy assistant to the president, but she also had two line deputies to sort of manage the staff, and he's chief of staff, executive kahuna, he's everything. So on the line deputy thing, Jack Burgess had been selected to manage what was called the commerce portfolio and all those special assistants dealing with business, labor, agriculture. And she thought she would like a woman to manage what called the human services portfolio, and that's all the minorities, the women, consumers, the aging, who we affectionately called the bleeders and screamers portfolio, or nuts and flakes portfolio. Affectionately, we did that. And so the fact that I came as a twofer, that I had campaign experience, I was a Hispanic, and a woman, worked to my advantage. And I had one conversation with Elizabeth Dole, and that it was very quick decision on her part and on mine. So managing all those groups, I focused very heavily on Hispanics, and then we brought Henry Zuniga in to be the special assistant, so I was just then managing that outreach, and then I devoted myself at least 50 to 70% of my time to putting together a strategy for women for the president. And so that's been a new frontier, and very challenging, and I think rewarding too.
Wonderful. Can you talk a little bit about that? What you tried to do, and what have been the great accomplishments you see, and perhaps even the problems?
Oh, surely. This is my favorite subject. Starting off, the decision had been made, rightly so, to avoid getting into the same problems that President Carter, that President Carter got himself into. You will remember that he had a very visible, very large, and activist advocacy group here in his White House. First under, was it Midge Costanza? And then later under Sarah Weddington. Very powerful, big advocacy group. It worked to his ultimate detriment, because he had this in-house advocacy, and when the women didn't get what they thought they deserved, then they turned against him. That is why he had to fire Midge Costanza, why he brought in someone else. Elizabeth Dole and President Reagan both very rightly wanted to avoid that. And there was the decision early on was not to have a special assistant to the president for women's affairs. That's how we started off. We recognized after about 6 months that whether or not you call it that, there was certainly a need. The ERA debate was raging. It was in high gear. The organized women's groups needed a place to come to, someone to talk to. And without such a person here, then Elizabeth was being forced to do that herself, and that was not good to put someone at that level. So we did hire someone. We didn't call it a special assistant to the president for women's affairs, but in effect that's what she did. That worked moderately well. That person left the White House to take another position. She became deputy undersecretary, and that's Wendy Borchert. Right. And at her departure then created a real vacuum. I stepped in with Elizabeth's concurrence and developed a long-term strategy, because at that point, 9 months ago, I would say that the consensus was that the president was not doing very well with women. We were starting to get the polls that indicated the gender gap. There was a fairly widespread feeling among organized women that there didn't seem to be a very keen sensitivity on the part of the White House to women, and there was a problem in the way that he communicated. Our polls were indicating this too. It wasn't just substance, but also form. So we needed to fix it. And so about 9 months ago, we started working on a long-term strategy, which would A, target the women who we were losing, and B, develop ways to appeal to them both through policy, significant policy initiatives, and communication and changes in the way we communicated. That plan was written by me and with a lot of help from women in the community, the women's groups themselves, after extensive consultations, and was then submitted to the White House Coordinating Council on Women. I may remark that that group was created at Elizabeth Dole's suggestion. It was an idea that I thought up with some friends, because and it turned out to be an excellent vehicle to help the president, because we realized that the Office of Public Liaison, as one group, as the liaison organization, could not in effect implement policy or implement changes in communication. It couldn't do the job. But what we needed was a high-level group that would bring together all the people, all the resources, and the heads of these offices in the White House and talk about the problems and get concurrence on what to do. And it has worked. It has been extremely successful. People who were participants in this group originally didn't know very much about the women's problems, and there was an education process that needed to take place. And we did that. And people like Joe Wright, who is the deputy director of OMB, Ed Harper from policy, Dave Gergen, communications, Helene Von Damme, presidential personnel, all sat around the table and heard briefings about what's happening to women in the workforce, from Dick Worthlin, what the causes of the gender gap are, when some things that we could do about it. The sensitivities were heightened greatly, and the enthusiasm of the group to find a solution became very keen. So therefore, when the plan was submitted to them, it was studied very carefully and was greeted with wild enthusiasm. Mm.
About what time period was this generally?
The Coordinating Council was formed in August of this year. And at that point, I was already working on the plan. They have met very frequently, and the strategy, the women's strategy, was submitted for their approval in October or November timeframe, maybe November. And the policies were pushed through as part of the midterm planning process and then incorporated into the State of the Union. An important thing, is this getting too long? Are you interested?
Fascinating.
Okay, because I mean, I could go on for as long as you need.
That's the purpose of this.
Oh, okay.
But to catch you at this point while it's still fresh in your mind.
Oh, wonderful.
And, this is just exactly the type of material that this whole program is set up to get.
Oh, that's wonderful, because this, the women's thing, even more than the Hispanic, is going to be relevant in 84.
Mm-hmm.
I say that with complete confidence. I know from where I speak. And so then let me spend just a minute talking about the targeting effort, because that was, as in any political effort, you have to know who you're talking to. And that was a problem for us, because this president has a unique, he's coming from a unique standpoint. He had, he was elected with the enthusiastic support of traditional homemaker, pro-family, pro-life women, as typified by Phyllis Schlafly, who was very effective in working, I think, for the president and mobilizing conservative support for the president. However, for every woman who admires Phyllis Schlafly, there is another, or maybe two, who doesn't agree with everything that Phyllis stands for. So the president had a real problem, and still does, I believe, with the women who would be characterized as the now activists, and we would characterize these women as being pro-ERA, pro-choice, feminist activists.
Mm-hmm.
So we're polarized. One group very positive for the president, very specific about what they want him to do. Another group very, very negative. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the negative group has the ear and the rapt attention of the East Coast liberal media. And whenever Eleanor Schmiel wanted to say, take a shot at the president, I mean, it was guaranteed New York Times, Washington Post coverage. Our task was to figure out where in the middle, where is everybody else? There are millions of women who neither identify with Phyllis Schlafly nor Eleanor Schmiel, who are not affiliated with either group, but who could support the president and either did, and probably did vote for him because they felt he would be an effective leader. And indeed, the poll, the whole gender gap data indicated that it was this group in the middle who the president was losing, because he never had the left. And he had the right, and still does. And unless he would drastically change his position on ERA or pro-life, which he was not about to do, he had those people. The perception from the middle is that what we learned is that we were losing support from our own Republican moderate women. And these are women who, by and large, did support the ERA, but could forgive the president for not supporting it, but didn't see anything else. So we were losing it from our very own Republican women and from the women of Democrats and independents or not affiliated women who were in the workforce, working hard, doing their best to keep their families together in a difficult economy, and just didn't feel that this president had any idea where they were coming from, that somehow they weren't part of all this plan. These are the women who, whether consciously or subconsciously, reacted to the fact that it was always the president with the boys, Ed Meese, Jim Baker, Mike Deaver, never saw any women, he never talked about women, and somehow they felt that the president really believed that all marriages in the world ought to be like his, and that all women ought to be like Nancy, and that isn't a reality in the real world. So hence, based on all that data and trying to figure out who these women were, we targeted the following groups: moderate, disaffected Republican women who felt that they're, who we're going to have a hard time motivating in 1984 if we don't get them back, because these are women who have said, well, you know, I'm a Republican, I support the president, but, you know, he's not doing, I don't see that he's doing much for me on this, you know, at me as a woman. So at the very top of our list, disaffected Republican women, and specifically moderates. Working women, we are targeted. Working women who are struggling, because most working women are not making big salaries. Many working women are supporting families. Many working women are single heads of households. These are the women who we're targeting. We are not, when I say targeting, I mean making a special effort to go. We are not targeting women who are not working, whether they are staying home. That doesn't mean that we don't want their support, but we assume for the women who are staying home, who have husbands who are supporting them, we feel that these women probably are likely to support the president already. If they're not working because they're welfare recipients, then they're not our target constituency. Mm-hmm. So we're after these working women who are struggling to get ahead, who are sensitive to the economy now, who are getting enlightened in ways that they have never been before, because they've never been in the workforce in these numbers before. And the way that we're going after them is, as I said, and I would, if tomorrow the campaign were starting, I would take this strategy document, which is called the 52% Solution, which is not my name, but someone else, I thought that was effective, and I would implement it in precisely this way. And it's a policy initiative is one section, and then communications. On policy, we've divided policy into two sections. You need to demonstrate to these women a commitment to legal equity. And that is, the president has always said that legal equity can be obtained without changing the Constitution. And he's got to demonstrate that he means it. You have to do something. You have to demonstrate that you've identified laws that discriminate and you've changed them. And in fact, we are doing just that through a project, through an executive order, which I helped write, which created the Task Force on Legal Equity for Women. The Justice Department is now completing the review of the federal code to identify those laws. One bill has already been introduced by Senator Dole to correct 100. That project must be finished by the time the campaign gets in gear, or the president will have a problem.
What about the 50 States Project? Wasn't that related?
Yes.
To this?
The 50 States Project is the flip side of that, and it is part B of the legal equity program. The first one is at the federal level. The 50 States Project is the same project at the state level, and it's much more difficult to implement this at the state level, because clearly the president cannot himself tell the governors what to do. Many of these governors are Democrats. That project needs attention. Elizabeth Dole has breathed life into that project. It is now staffed and it's moving. But it's terribly important by 1984 for the president to demonstrate that he has exercised leadership, that he has worked with the governors, that they have identified laws, and that these laws have been changed. Otherwise, he will have a very difficult time selling his position on the ERA and legal equity. Mm-hmm. Although, I don't want to oversell the ERA. I don't think it will be the issue in 84 that it was in 80. But still, women are concerned. Women don't believe, by and large, that everything is fine. And, you know, I mean, that the Equal Pay Act is being enforced. They don't believe that. They know that equal pay for equal work is still not a reality in many cases, but I think they'll be willing to come along and say, when they see progress in other areas, when they see inequities changed. So legal equity is the first part. Equally important, or more important, I would say, is economic equity. The president must take the initiative and appeal to our target women, the working women, by demonstrating his commitment to making sure that in the economic arena that women don't get treated at a disadvantage. There are several ways we're talking about doing that. Number one is enforcement of the Equal Pay Act and paying attention and saying it and telling the Attorney General, if necessary through a memo or in a speech, that we will not tolerate women doing the same job under the same conditions and getting paid less money. Number one, an economic consideration, number two, which is very important, is increased vigorous support of child support enforcement laws. Many women, a staggering number, I think that it's close to 70% of women who are entitled to child support, and I don't mean alimony, I mean child support, never receive this support from their divorced spouses or whatever. This forces them, this forces an economic hardship on them and the children who they are working to support. Laws are on the books. It is against the law not to provide for support for your child. However, these laws are not vigorously enforced, and there's a problem with interstate cooperation. The president took the lead in this project in California and tightened up the laws and got a lot of credit. And what we're going to do as part of this, and you'll see it as it's as it unfolds, this project, is to make this a national priority and for the president to talk about it. So child support enforcement is a winner. Everybody's for that. There's child care. The president needs to convince American women that he understands the need for quality child care for women who work. This does not mean that we want the federal government to fund child care centers, but by focusing on attention and getting the community as part of our private sector initiatives effort, the PSI group has made child care a priority. So they will be focusing on that. And then I don't want to forget, in the economic equity area, the issue of pensions. Women are now in the workforce. They don't get vested, you know, they're not unionized as much as men, and women are now recognizing the need to take care of themselves as workers and not to rely on their husbands and not to rely just on Social Security. I mean, this is a very, very hot issue for women. The president announced in the State of the Union, at our recommendation, his intention to support legislation to correct pension inequities, of which there are many, which result in lower pensions for men, for women, than men, even though the contributions are the same. He will change that. And if properly publicized, that should be a big selling point. That is economic equity. The new frontier that we need to look at is sex discrimination in insurance. The administration hasn't taken a position on that. But there is evidence that women, because of the use of sex-based actuarial tables in life insurance, may suffer a disadvantage. So we're looking at that. So in other words, this is part of the whole thing called economic equity. These are some of the issues, policy initiatives which have been signed off yet, but which have not been announced. And then just to wrap this up really quickly, I talked about the need for better communication. Doing all this does nothing if the women of America don't know about it. The president must, and this is part of the communications plan of the strategy that we submitted, the president must speak to women. He must make a speech on and recognize, on whether it's a Saturday radio talk or a major speech out of town to a big convention, he must make a speech on women, recognizing the emerging role of women, and maybe even recognizing the gender gap, and telling the women of America what he plans to do. He must talk to them. He must be seen photographed with women like Elizabeth Dole and Peggy Heckler, and the women in this administration, the Ann Gorsuches, who are here. He must be seen as to be a person who relies on women for advice, who recognizes them, who is sensitive to the needs of working women, and not just women who stay home. And if he does that, and implements these substantive policy initiatives, we will have no problem with the women in 1984.
That's a wonderful summary off the cuff of that whole plan.
Well, I know it very well.
What have been the areas of disagreement? You said it was greeted with great acclaim by the coordinating committee. Have there been some aspects of the communication outreach that have, for instance, Mr. Gergen, who was on the coordinating committee?
Well, the basic problem, if you want to call it a problem, is that I believe because of the ERA debate and of the intensity of the feeling on the abortion issue, that the leadership at the White House at the very top level was gun-shy about dealing with anything having to do with women. For example, every group, the most hostile black groups have been in for meetings with the president. The most hostile Hispanics, the most hostile labor leaders have been brought in. But the president has had not one meeting with the leaders of women's organizations because there was this terror about how to resolve these irresolvable issues. There was a fear, if you want to call it, of what are we going to do if we get Phyllis Schlafly and Eleanor Smeal in the room together with the president. And that's a legitimate fear, believe me. And I mean, I myself had to recommend against that kind of a meeting because I didn't see how it could be worked out. So there was a fear about dealing with anything with women. There's a fear that it was, in a way, hopeless, that there is nothing that we can do to mollify the feminists. But of course, that was the wrong question because it wasn't the feminists who need to be mollified. We were targeting the wrong group. We were fearing the wrong group. So the first effort was to, I think, educate. Without the education process that took place of the White House Coordinating Council members themselves, we would never have reached agreement that there was something that we could do. And we would not have been able to get down to the specifics of what legal equity issues are and that business. And we'd still be saying, well, we can't support the ERA and we're not going to change our position on abortion, so there's nothing to meet with women about. And there was also a very strong faction at the highest levels that felt that that the economy was the issue. And if the economy turned around, then there was no need to specifically target women as a group. And so therefore all this was wasted effort and a lot of effort that wouldn't really win. And I can't argue with that. I mean, everyone agrees that the economy is foremost and that if unemployment is at 11% in 84, that we've got a big problem. But quite aside from that, that doesn't answer the gender gap. The economy does not answer the gender gap. And there was a problem there which said that women were just starting to really turn off. But as women, different than men and different than other groups. And finally, so to get to your point, to answer your question, the biggest problem that we had was convincing, bringing to the table and reaching agreement there that there was something that we could do.
There was a targeted group.
Yes.
That could be reached.
And it wasn't simply mollifying the feminists, the hard left.
What helped you? Let me turn this off. This is side two. An interview with Diana Lozano on February 3rd, 1983. Interviewer is Marie Allen.